Welcome to The Dirty Inning, another episode of the Terrible Phillies podcast in which we go back deep into the archives and dig up the dumbest, most forgotten, or funniest, or stupidest innings in Philadelphia Phillies history. I am Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight. With me is Dr. Trevor Strunk.
Hello, Doc. Come on.
One of these times. We're going to nail that opening.
I think it's important that people know that we mean we're the terrible podcast, and that we, like, it's terrible in a sort of like a holy terror kind of way. Not that the podcast is terrible. The podcast is good.
Oh, you mean because it's a podcast about how terrible the Phillies have been, and the itself isn't terrible. Okay.
Yeah, the podcast itself is not terrible.
Are you sure? Because we were supposed to record this episode earlier in this week, and I know all these episodes have a very timeless quality to them.
They are extremely timeless.
But I was supposed to record earlier in this week, and because of a power shortage in half of my apartment, we were unable to, and I assumed it was some sort of Jaws the Revenge situation involving a possum that used to live in the walls of my apartment in Brewery Town. Instead, I had just plugged too many things into an outlet. And
well, first off, let me say, great Jaws the Revenge pull.
I like to make references everyone can enjoy. You know, universally understood cinematic references.
People love Jaws the Revenge. It's just a true thing about us as Philadelphians and people.
Oh, classic Philadelphia movie, Jaws the Revenge. Yeah. Up there with Silver Linings Playbook, Rocky, and The Island of Dr. Moreau. Yeah.
Dr. Moreau, he was a Gruden grinder in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's the most common. I heard that was the inspiration for Brando's performance in that classic.
Was John Gruden?
Yes.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Timeless quality. Timeless. So Trevor, you know.
Off to a great start.
Here we are. Here we are in mid-August. We've seen entirely too much Phillies baseball.
I wish we could see less.
Honestly, it's an overdose. And the ways we've digested these games, you know, seen a couple games down at Old Citizens Bank Park, down at the bank. You listen to a lot of games on the radio, you catch most of the games on TV. You do. And the broadcast world has changed over the years. You know, we used to. It's now very nostalgic to turn on watch a YouTube clip from an old game and hear that old instrumental beginning to Phillies broadcasts when they were on Prism, or even earlier, way back in the day. I mean, they used to be on UPN 15.
Yep.
They used to put a lot of games on CW Philly. I mean, it's just a lot of memories come roaring back when that.
And everyone came. Remembers the theme, that great theme of it, mm-hmm. where it goes da 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 da
time,
dun, 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 dun.
And the dancing Philadelphia robot. Yeah, we all remember.
Who we all loathe. Cletus, the dancing Philadelphia robot.
He's actually made of batteries. Yeah. Little known fact about the design of that robot. But yeah, we've digested Phillies games in a lot of ways over the years, and you know now I'm wondering, because a couple of weeks ago, last year the Phillies were all these years the Phillies have been a bad team, and as the broadcast landscape has changed, they've pretty much I think been used as a guinea pig in all the new formats. So when there was like, oh, we need teams to play in one of these dumbass Facebook games, oh, who are the Phillies playing today?
Because I mean, why not, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's not as if. It really isn't as if, like, anyone's going to be too upset. It's just going to be a bunch of Phillies fans who are like, hey, why'd you do that? And then they'll say, like, well, we're still going to do it. And the worst thing the Phillies fans can do is say, well, I'm not going to watch my dumb team this today.
Right. Exactly. And
all right, fine. Don't.
The worst thing we did was complain about it while still doing it. So we didn't have a lot of leverage in that scenario.
Truly, truly a miserable, miserable fan base.
But this year, I don't think, no more Facebook games, I don't think, this year. But we did see some YouTube games this year, and very recently there was a YouTube game. Trev, did you watch any of that and get that experience?
Absolutely not. I never go on. I never watch live sporting events on YouTube.
Wow.
Far too much respect for myself.
I'm a little surprised by that. I'm not going to lie.
Are you? I like.
No, I'm not.
Oh, I'll be honest though. Like, I like the idea of a YouTube style sports streaming service that I could use to cut the cord. But I mean, MLB's for YouTube game of the week is not it.
Oh, no, yeah, no. And honestly, any game where the commentators are Ben Davis and Harold Reynolds, that's that's a 1-2 punch of hell no going on.
No, thank you. Check, please.
That's like willfully listening to a podcast about how terrible your favorite team is. So.
Who would do such a thing? Hopefully thousands of people.
Thousands upon thousands of avid listeners, yes. Well, also, you know, as the Phillies have themselves searched for novel broadcast concepts, we get things like even just this past week when the Phillies broadcast team moved down behind the Phillies dugout to broadcast the game.
Yeah.
We saw that. We saw a couple of years we've seen them go out into the stands. There was that year Tom McCarthy actually caught a home run ball while they were broadcasting out in the stands in the outfield.
Your best friend Tom McCarthy, as I'm to understand.
Hey, you know what? I can't say that I cherish the television broadcasts of the Philadelphia Phillies, but I got to say I have softened a great deal more because out of sympathy, because of how much shit the Phillies TV broadcast crew takes. But also because I know it's a hard and thankless job, and I don't want to, you know, hey, it's they do it professionally, you know? I mean, Kruk is, I like Kruk, but man, I don't think he even wants to be in there anymore, you know?
No, I think the funny thing about the Phillies TV team is how much better the radio team is. Like, it always just blows my mind how much more I'd rather listen to Scott in L.A., or Scott, or Jim Jackson in L.A., or I don't know, like anything. Like, I guess when Ben Davis is in there, it's not good.
Jim Jackson has broadcast his last Phillies game, at least of the season, possibly forever. I believe he's moving over to, he's either hosting a show. I should have had this full information before I started talking, but was he either the time of year where he was moving away from the Phillies and doing something else as he typically did, or
he's just joining the military.
I think he's going to serve our country in a secret war in a black ops operation overseas, and they wouldn't talk any more about it.
Just Jim Jackson being truly the worst person you could have at a deep op. Oh boy,
taking heavy fire over here. Well, man down as bullets strike the tree next to me,
and I have a shot lined up over the corner. You better hope he doesn't hear this one.
Well,
Jim Jackson deep cover.
Hopefully the last thing he hears is the soft whistle of a bullet streaking towards his exposed head. That's neither here nor there at this point. But yeah, the changing face of the Phillies broadcast at this point in time.
Well, that's sad. I hope I don't, Jim Jackson's not my favorite, but I do hope that he has not broadcast his last game. I think he is a valuable member of the team.
Yeah, I was during a rain delay that he was talking with one of the other producers on a Phillies radio broadcast, and they said something about him moving over to either a program he was now hosting or another broadcasting thing that he was doing for the network, and I can't remember, but he was going to be unavailable for Phillies games for the rest, at least, of the season. So I remember that, but I like Jim Jackson. I think he's great as the Flyers announcer.
I think he's much better as the Flyers announcer than he is as the Phillies announcer. I don't think he's bad as the Phillies announcer. No. I think he is a little too excitable.
Yeah, you can tell he's definitely trained to be a hockey announcer, always following the action.
Yeah.
And it's just baseball's a sport with less action. But I bring up...
Yes.
I bring up the broadcast because, Trev, back on June 9th, 1967, the Phillies broadcast was canceled. Yeah, it was supposed to... Everybody, a bunch of Delaware Valley citizens sat down in their easy chairs, finished their frozen TV dinners... flipped to Channel 6, assuming they were about to see Rick Wise and their Philadelphia Phillies take on the Pittsburgh Pirates at Forbes Field in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And what do you know?
What happened?
That game just wasn't on. You know what game was on?
What's that?
A United Nations session.
The Game of Thrones.
Now, I didn't look into this. I ran out of time before I could look into this. So this is, I'm guessing that there was a United Nations session being televised because the Six-Day War had broken out.
Justin, do you want to explain all the politics behind the Six-Day War to us?
I do not. And I'm assuming everyone in this audience...
just has to be familiar with the Six-Day War.
Has a deep understanding of the context and just, events.
People know their Israeli-Palestinian history in this audience. It's what I say about this podcast.
But I believe that would probably have been the global cataclysm happening that would cause the United Nations session to be aired on Channel 6 instead of a sporting event, which, honestly, to think of that in the context of today is like, well, A, they would just put it on another channel, and B, no one...
People would be furious.
No one would care. I mean, no one would care that it was on because right. They would be watching sports on another channel, and like they just would not be paying. Nobody, like, it's like C-SPAN 3 and 4 at this point, you know?
Can you imagine if like a football game was delayed because of global events?
Oh, this has happened, and people have been inconsolable.
Well, there's the Heidi game, right? Or the Sound of Music game, I can't remember, where it was like a Jets game that was like super exciting, and then the last bit of it was cut off for Heidi.
That's right.
Which is incredible.
Sports fans, notoriously reasonable.
Oh, well, that's okay. Mistakes happen.
You know, I've never actually seen the end of this, so happy to watch.
Yeah, I wonder if Heidi gets out.
I wonder if everything shakes out for old Heidi. But yeah, that's one of several just interesting situations around and during this game. So didn't even air on the right channel because of a United Nations session being aired instead. The third base coach of the Phillies, George Mihiot, was ejected with one out in the first inning.
Is that good?
Because the umpire called a trickler in front of the plate, hit by an opposing batter. He called it fair. George was very sure, adamant, in fact, that it was foul. Was not going to win that argument because no one ever wins an argument against an umpire.
Yeah, that's I mean, like, even today where, like, you can win an argument against an umpire sometimes, I don't think that's when you're going to win.
No. Imagine, like, a 60s umpire, too. I mean, they basically, it was, like, the police, the local police, and then the umpires, and then regular, like, civilians. That's actually how that went down, which is why umpires today have such a scrambled view of their authority, I think.
Because they think they're the police?
Yes.
That's horrible.
They genuinely believe they are a form of law enforcement. Otherwise, I mean, that I don't know how else to explain their behavior, their view
their
of themselves.
Truly, truly grim behavior and understanding of the game. Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it's a strange thing, and I guess it makes a lot of sense. I mean, we've talked about it on this show before, where like the way that umpires were treated and understood in the past, particularly like as regards when they got hit by players or whatever, like
knocked the hell unconscious.
Yeah, like the question of, well, what's going to happen was more like, oh geez, you punched a cop kind of thing. Like it was not like, yeah, you hit an umpire, that's not nice. It's like, oh no, you're gonna go to big jail.
Oh yeah, the umps are leaving their badges at home for this one. Yeah. Well, yeah, so we lost the third base coach of the Phillies 1/3 of the way through the first inning of this game.
It's not a big deal.
Forcing our boy Gene Mock to come out of the dugout as the manager and coach third base himself.
I bet he did a great job.
I bet he did, too. I kept waiting as I read more and more about this game to learn of what horrible cataclysm occurred because Gene Mock was allowed out of the dugout and onto the field. But that seems like it worked out okay.
Gene Mock just like... Ushering the slowest player.
Switching clothes with his player on third base so that he can try and steal home.
Just looking over at the guy on first, there's like a pop fly, and he's like, tag and run to home! Tag and run to home!
No, what are you talking about, Blue? It's me, Dick Groat. Can't you see the name on my uniform? Got him. So we lose the TV broadcast, we lose the third base coach, all before the end of the top of the first inning, which the first inning was described as a nightmare for young Phillies starter Rick Wise.
Rick Wise shows up a lot in this show.
He does. The 60s are a gold mine, frankly, for the kind of games we like to cover.
I love doing a 60s show. You asked me which year I wanted to do. It was like this, 65 and 95, and I was like, oh, 67.
Oh yeah.
Forever.
prime time. Yeah, two games
in. We gotta do it.
Two games in years right next to each other, or the late 90s. And, I mean, both is all, it's all fertile ground.
But, oh, it's all great, but there's something so good about the 60s and the Phillies. They're just so awful.
I think part of it is because we didn't see these players play, and so it's much more easy to imagine their cartoonish exploits. But yeah, Rick Wise just wasn't having his best game, and it was described as a nightmare in the paper in the first inning, that is, and it was the kind of nightmare in which you are singled to death by the Pittsburgh Pirates. In the first inning, there were two infield singles, one to shortstop, one to second. Ugh. Then another single to second that scored a run. Then a bloop single over second. Then a ground ball single. Then another ground ball single. At this point, it's 5-0. Rick Wise hadn't until now given up an earned run in 15 innings leading up to this first inning. So
I mean, you got to be feeling confident then in your starter. And when this happens, I mean, it's hard to be nice to starters when this happens in today, like in a kinder, gentler time. But like, I have to imagine that if you're watching this as someone in that era, you're just like real mad at Rick Wise. Like, you're just thinking, where is your mental toughness,
right,
Rick?
Well, Wise? this one's over, you know. You're already thinking, I mean, right, as we speak, the Phillies are losing 5-0. Timeless quality. And you know, I'm like, oh, okay, that game's over.
I wouldn't continue watching at this point. There's no real reason. They'll just lose.
So Rick Wise is getting, I was going to say shelled, but really more just like pecked and poked, touched.
Yeah, I would say the Phillies tonight are getting shelled.
Yeah. The Pirates scored one of their runs when Gene Oliver, catching in his first game with the Phillies, launched a return throw, just a return throw, not trying to get the guy at second, just throwing it back to the pitcher.
Yeah, the thing that you always can do when you're a catcher.
Or a baseball player, or even a child.
I think I could do it. I don't think I can do much, but I think I could do that.
I got to tell you, until I read about this, I was under the impression I could do 0% of the things professional athletes can do. I could throw a ball from my knees, from home plate, to a pitcher on the mound. I could do that. I'm not saying I would every time, or even the first time.
No one's saying you have to do it every time.
Right. But
if you can do it once, you're really kind of one up on Oliver.
Gene Oliver launches a return throw back to starter Rick Wise so terrible it rolled away, and Willie Stargell was able to run home from third and score. Wow. Willie Stargell, a base runner who I once watched video footage of sliding into second base and trying to call timeout while he was sliding because he knew he was out.
That rules. I love the old Pirates. They're all so good.
The pillbox hat Pirates, they had the best pillbox
hats.
Just
the best.
The fans at Forbes Field were called bloodthirsty by the press. I don't think they were really up to anything too bloodthirsty. But
Do you think they were drinking blood?
I think metaphorically, it was sort of like the Pirates hadn't been doing so well leading up to this game either. And I think they were just, it was just like chum in the water, and they were just like ready for a win, and they could see the Pirates were ready to just devour the Phillies, and they were like, they were driven into a bloodthirsty craze in that context, because they started chanting.
In the context of bloodlust.
Also that, you know, they carried around a little vial of blood around their necks to sip at their fancy, as was the style at the time.
What they call the fans bloodthirsty? Oh, because they like to drink blood.
We're reporters. We speak only in the literal and the objective. If I say they're bloodthirsty, you know what I mean.
They're thirsty for blood.
So they're chanting and hooting at the players with joy. The Pirates had only won 4 of their last 10 leading into this game. And the Pirates fans started chanting, more meetings, because the Pirates had a closed-door meeting after a recent humiliating loss to the Mets, who were bad at this time. And that was earlier in the week. So they had this closed-door meeting in which I guess they just agreed to pulverize the stupid Phillies when they played them.
There's nothing funnier than when people believe that closed-door meetings really make a difference. It's the funniest thing in the world, where they're like, well, I heard the Phillies had a closed-door meeting. Let's see how this goes. When their next game, people are like, that closed-door meeting really did the trick.
Yeah, it looks like they really screamed themselves. How much screaming do you really think? They say closed-door, and like the inference there is someone was yelling or screaming, right?
I mean, do they like it's, but what's weird to me is that, like, do they close the door and then say, like, okay, by closed door we mean specifically you are not allowed to record any of this, like you're this is haram to reporters? Or is it just like, we're gonna close the door, if you hear anything, just, you know, whatever, but the door is closed, you're not coming in?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but closed door and players only is the same thing? Or did players only mean, like, no coaches, we're trying to police this ourselves?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think players only might be, like, truly players only, no coaches.
Okay, that would make sense. And I guess closed door then means, like, you know, the coaches and manager are there. But
coaches get to be there. Coaches like, can we be there?
The idea being, this isn't, like, a bit. This isn't for the press. This isn't for the people to know. This is just
we're not doing kayfabe.
Right.
But, like, what could even be said back there? Like, what do they say that they can't say to the press? Like, we're not going to make very much money, and we hate the fans. Yeah, they probably say they don't like the press. That could be.
I mean, you're a different person when there's cameras on you. I think it just comes down to that, you know?
Are you?
All the time. And I'm in front of cameras constantly. So
people love to film you.
Yeah, I'm constantly sought out for my image, yes. Right, the very lush medium of car screaming. Yes. Yeah, we're just, yeah, it's part of the landscape now.
It's closed door car screaming.
Right.
So, you know, you can listen to Justin do it, but sometimes Justin's going to be there for Justin.
Right, exactly. So, this game, a loss to the Pirates at Forbes Field on June 9th, 1967, was the Phillies' worst loss since Sandy Koufax had pummeled them to the same score 5 years prior at Dodger Stadium.
I mean, if you have to be pummeled by someone.
Right. In this case, you know, no Sandy Koufax to be seen. Instead, the Phillies were humbled by Billy O'Dell, a Pirates
pitcher. The immortal
pitcher,
Billy O'Dell.
A Pirates pitcher who threw 9 innings, allowed 1 earned run, and only struck out 1 guy. Finished the game with an ERA of 4.05. Kind of pitcher you really expect to just hold you down and, you know,
you joke, but honestly, if I'm the Phillies, I do expect that.
Yeah, you know, just generation to generation, it's probably something that people should start expecting.
Yeah, is there a bad pitcher? Does he seem mostly mediocre? Does he not have a good fastball? Is
entirely beatable?
Yeah, is he having a run of bad luck? Has the worst team in the league just hung 9 on him? I have bad news about the Phillies game that you're going to watch. It's not going to be very fun.
They are about to get perfect gamed. And I don't know how to explain this to you, but it's an utter assurance, inevitably.
I forget who was the one. There was someone ridiculous that they were getting perfect gamed by, and the Reds were playing them. Who the heck was it? But I remember it was like kind of a guy where people were like, "Oh, cool! Like this guy's like really underheralded and neat." I remember seeing this. It wasn't maybe on Twitter. I think it was before I was on Twitter, but I think I was on the Good Fight game thread back in the day, and and before I was writing there, and I remember they almost got perfect game by this like total nobody on the Reds, like sort of like a meat and potatoes pitcher, and Matt Stairs hit a home run to end the perfecto, and they were obviously going to lose, and I remember people being like, "Oh man, that sucks!" Like, just like, you know, let the guy have his perfect game, or let the guy have his no hitter, like, ah, oh, that sucks to see history go away. I remember being like, yes, good.
No, that's the perfect time to do it.
You should, just for spite.
That's honestly, Matt Stairs is only going to swing to get one kind of hit. So
yeah, if you put Matt Stairs in, you know what you're getting.
It's the same thing as you know, somebody else knocking a single. He just only swings to hit home runs. So that's what's going to happen.
If you let up a hit, it's going to be a homer. And that's all. Yeah.
Well, an injured Dick Groat for the Phillies showed up for a second inning pinch hit appearance.
Quote
and
unquote
popped
Dick
out.
Groat.
I mean, the newspaper.
We know who it was.
The newspaper describing this event read, "Dick still considerably limp." Wow.
Yeah.
I added the wow. Yeah.
I mean, they could have also added the wow there.
That
just an utter shame at what they've done.
That was in the newspaper. In 1967. Go ahead.
I have to wonder if they're being, like, serious there. Like, is that a joke? Or do they just, like, not know how words work? Is this, like...
I mean, at this point, I think maybe they're trusting the public to not assume it was on purpose. But has to be on purpose, right?
It's like that old Batman comic where the Joker keeps saying he's, like, committing... and he means pranks, but he keeps saying he's committing boners.
Yes.
Yeah. I just, like, every time I look at it, I'm like, now, Listen, you can't possibly mean boner.
Well, we'll see. You know, we'll see what the Pirates were actually meaning here. They clearly had rallied in the locker room. They came out ready to win.
Yeah.
Everything had gone poorly. The Phillies had lost their third base coach. They had lost their TV signal. Their starter was getting utterly pecked to death in the first inning. So
many of them were just like thinking about the Middle East.
Everyone was a little distracted.
Tensions were running high in the Phillies locker room. Some heavy Palestinian partisans. Of course, like big-time Israeli boosters. It was rough.
So we're going to get a little distracted and take our first break. Well, Trev, GM John Quinn of the Phillies had actually just told the Inquirer in June 1967 that he believed their top slugger, Rich Allen, a.k.a. Dick Allen, could hit 30 home runs that year. And also that if he didn't, it would deeply impact the team's playoff hopes. Now, first of all, I kept reading Rich Allen's name and wondering who is that until I finally put it together who they were talking about.
Just like some like preeminent slugger you've never heard of.
Like, I was like, wow.
For this long, I think I probably know half of the Phillies players.
I was kind of floored. I was like, wait, Rich, maybe that's just like a normal named guy who was like considered a power threat, but never really blah, blah, blah. But I realized later, oh, right. Yeah. 67. It's Dick Allen. Right. Okay.
It's funny. Like, that's like kind of how I felt when I learned how, not Del Ennis, but maybe it was Del Ennis, the guy who, we talked about it, I think, last episode, the guy who got so drunk on a Niagara Falls tour that he got kicked off the bus and then was so drunk that he walked into Niagara Falls and died.
That wasn't Del Ennis. That's isn't that Delahunt?
Ed Delante.
Delante, yeah.
But that was kind of what I thought, where I was like, this can't, that's too crazy to be Big Ed Delante. Like, there's no way. It's like, I know how you feel. Like, it's like, we know enough about the past. It's like, I feel like I would know this at this point. Let's be serious. I would know if there was some slugger named Rich Allen.
Well, now we've talked about this before on this podcast, as I believe I've read the passage from Dick Allen's memoirs about accidentally putting his hand through a car headlight. Do you remember this?
Nope.
Well, I feel like I definitely did. It was a rainstorm.
You do a lot of podcasts.
But I would only talk about this on this podcast.
I don't know.
Sure.
I could see you talking about it with Liz.
His car wouldn't start. It was raining, and he was pushing it up the driveway, and he slipped, and his hand went through the car headlight. And I remember the passage in the book. He said he looked down at his hand, and all he saw was just like spaghetti, and it was disgusting description. And he mangled it so badly it cut his season short. He only played in 122 games that year only, and so he only hit 23 home runs.
He could have done it.
Short of the 30 home runs John Quinn had hoped for. And the Phillies? Well, Trev, they finished 82-80 in fifth place at a point in time when finishing anywhere from third or below was the same thing as finishing in last place.
It's an incredible game that we follow.
So per Quinn on Allen's initial home run drought, he's hitting over 300, but I don't have a theory on why he hasn't been hitting home runs, except that certainly it has to be a matter of timing. So it kind of does sound like you have a theory, John, frankly.
The boy who only hit home runs.
I can't think of any reason why he wouldn't be hitting home runs, except that it's definitely his timing.
Well, outside of the obvious timing-based thing, and you could look at the hitch in his swing, and I've studied the tape. Outside of that, it's a mystery. No one knows.
You know, we do an awful lot of zeroing in on baseball at this point in time, and you know, probably too much.
No.
I see a lot of stuff being written about that I just personally don't care about.
Did you find anything on Dick Allen's launch angle?
Way too close a look at different components of the game. So it cracked me up to read about reporters talking about Dick Allen's home run drought and being like, you know, he hits a lot. But he puts solid wood on the ball, but you know, his ball's just not going out, and they're just like, you know, it's not that they didn't have a way to or couldn't theorize why he just wasn't hitting home runs. It was more just that, like, it wasn't important. It was just like, we're not bothering. He'll eventually hit home runs again. It was like a mystery they didn't care to figure out. And I was like, that's Yeah.
I feel like we could just, like, if we could just get someone from that period of time to replace Gabe Kapler, we would do a lot better.
I feel like if we could just have one of those guys on a beat, the rest of them can be as, you know, I've got nothing against analytics, but just like working with your gut, you can go too far in any direction. I feel like just get one of those guys on the beat to just be like the guy who was like, I don't know, ball didn't go out. Who cares?
Yeah, like, what? Why is Rhys Hoskins struggling so much? Oh, he'll probably do fine next time. Just keep hitting the ball.
Oh, he sucks. I don't know. Today he really sucked.
It's bad. Whatever. Once again, this is why I am very pleased that they have Charlie Manuel back.
So if you know Dick Allen, which neither of us do, but if we did,
my grandfather did. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah, he tutored his daughter.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So he knew Dick Allen. He had he had like a letter from him at one point or another saying, like, you know, thank you for all the work you've done with my daughter. It was during the period of time where Phillies fans were like super racist to him. Like it was kind of a big deal.
Wow, that is huge.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of my older relatives' relationships with known sports figures.
You're trying to one-up me on this?
I am. The one thing that came to mind is a guy my grandfather knew Don Shula, the coach of the Miami Dolphins.
Wow, really doing a great job one-upping.
And said, hey, something about like, oh, do you have something? I don't know. I don't know if it was like a souvenir. He was trying to get something for my grandfather to give me, something like that. And Don Shula took the hat off his head and gave it to him. And then he gave that to my grandfather, and he gave me this Miami Dolphins hat, and was just like, "Yo, this was on the coach's head." And I was like, "That's great." So I'm a little child. I don't know who Don Shula is. I do know that I'm supposed to write my name on all my clothes. So
yeah,
not my clothes, all my hats, because I had a lot of hats. I liked hats. So, you know, you've got this Miami Dolphins hat, collector's item. I don't know if you could really convince other people later in life.
It doesn't have like a certificate of authenticity. I don't think you lost out on millions here, but
with a magic marker, just huge messy kid writing says "Doc Dan" on the bottom half of the bill of this Don Shula cap.
Weirdly, brilliant. You know, the funny thing is though, that was Don Shula's main coaching strategy.
That hat had all my best plays in it.
Why did I give that hat to that kid?
Well. So again, we don't know Dick Allen, but if we did, we'd know he was the type of person who loved being told what was wrong with him by other people. So that Phillies Dick Allen relationship continued as amicably and nicely as it historically is known to have.
What I really like about Dick Allen is how, you know, as time's gone by, we all know that he was really happy here and we're all really pleased with how it ended.
I love Dick Allen. I think he's one of my favorite ball players.
I really like him, too. He's fantastic.
Yeah. So when asked why the Phillies had started 24-25 leading up to this point, June 9th in 1967, a slow stretch by any measurement,
mm-hmm.
Quinn, the GM, John Quinn, said as a reason for the team's initial struggles that their problems were contained to the defense and the offense. They did have plenty. They did have plenty of pitching and plenty of power, he said. So they could be fine.
The issue is just that they didn't have very good defense or offense.
Right, which in baseball is part of it.
Those are two of the things you need.
If you want to get into analytics, I mean, yeah, maybe. I guess.
I love that. Like it's like a football coach being like, we'd be good if the running game and the passing game and the coaching was better.
But we do have a solid defensive line when all of our team is healthy. So that's where the Phillies were at this point. And let me tell you, losing 16-1 to the Pirates was big news at this time. Mm-hmm. I think this is why older scribes who came up during this era are so aghast at the concept of the Orioles barely fielding a team and losing by lopsided scores every night, because this was considered a 16-1 loss, as one paper called it at the time, a quote, pitching tragedy. To have it happen once was newsworthy and gab-worthy and kind of an anomaly. You know, to have it happen repeatedly would be disgusting. Now, had the Phillies just lost 13-1 to the Cubs four nights earlier? Yes, they had, Trevor.
I bet the newspaper was really cool about that and didn't care. They were like, you know what, this is fine. This is how baseball goes. Sometimes this happens.
Newspapers at the time read like they are overjoyed to bring you this news. Like if the Phillies had won 16-1, same thing. Like I'm not saying they necessarily loved when
you're
the
not
Phillies
calling
lost,
them boo birds necessarily.
But they just loved when something crazy happened and it just comes across in the writing and the headlines. It's brilliant. But yeah, this was, you know, this was Philadelphia, 1967. That's what was going on in the city at the time. Just take a look around with me, Trev, as we walk down a city street in Philadelphia, 1967.
Oh, the time machine's going on. In some purple mountain of my kind. Whoa, Justin, look at those cool threads you have on now.
This is not the first time that song... Is that song powering the machine, or is that us going back in time and we're hearing that song?
I mean... You know, your guess is as good as mine as the actual mechanics of the time machine we have.
Right.
That we were gifted via the SB Nation headquarters.
Don Shula gave me this time machine.
Dun, 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 dun.
I wrote my name on it, devaluing it entirely.
Now we can only go back to times that are important to you.
So, you know, 1967 Philadelphia. People were not super happy, if you can believe that. Letters to the editor are to be believed. There's some drilling going on at 20th Street near Rittenhouse Square that one upper-class dandy simply could not abide.
Uh-oh.
They were awoken twice in one night by the sound of drilling, and in a letter to the editor of the Inquirer, stressed how they did not understand why it had to go on in the evening. The company was assuredly paying the workers more to work at night, so how did it benefit them? And also, there was no care being made to keep from disturbing the people of the neighborhood.
I love this guy just getting in the business of how drilling should work. Like,
yes.
You know, I'm not a big time drill expert, but from what I know,
yeah. No, I totally agree. It seemed like almost out of place that he suddenly was like, you know, I'm just thinking of the business's bottom line here. It can't be worth it.
You 100% are not, sir.
He said he was woken up at 1 a.m. and 3 a.m.
Oh,
I mean, this is intolerable.
Not just once, but twice.
Have you ever met any Rittenhouse Square people? And I don't mean people who, like, you know, lived somewhere else and moved there. Like, people who are like, went through some formative years as members of the Rittenhouse Square elite.
No, I've never actually met anyone who has would identify as the Rittenhouse Square elite.
So after college, when I was a broke...
Broken?
I was a broke college graduate,
oh,
I
okay,
guess.
Good,
we'll just
good,
say.
Good. That's better.
My job was walking dogs, and I Aww. Had one client in Rittenhouse Square. And
you will
had,
when you're walking dogs. That's 100% true. Yeah.
Yes. Now, I had a lot of clients that were like medical professionals who were gone during the day, and they needed their dogs walked and taken care of and everything. Rittenhouse Square, the client was a very, very old Cocker Spaniel who Aww. couldn't walk.
Poor guy.
Who was mostly entirely blind. Had to be
you know, the
up.
Entire audience is going to be really sympathetic to the Cocker Spaniel and not you.
Had to be picked up. The story is not about that.
Okay, good. I thought you were going to go there, and I was like, Justin, this is not going to go well for you.
Had to be picked up from wherever he was, placed in front of his food bowl, kind of shown where it is. Had to be picked up, taken down the elevator, put down on the grass in Rittenhouse Square, you know, permitted to, you know, you just dust would come out when you try to pee. He was so old. And then you just pick him back up, put him back in his house. So this was one of the few places where I would go where like people would actually be in the residence when I was in there. And there was a couple of these like two young girls. And like, it was honestly, they wouldn't even make eye contact with me. They wouldn't look at me. Even I was like, I was not there. Like I wasn't supposed to speak to them, address them. It was very much like, you know, you're just the help.
You're not meant to be.
Yeah, you're not meant to be. They just lived on another planet. And actually, one time I lost their key while I was out with the dog, and I had to go up and explain that to them. So first of all, I had to break that invisible wall between us.
Hello.
And they were kind of a mixture of like annoyed that I was talking to them, and also annoyed because like I don't care. Like you lost the key, I don't care. Like yeah, you'll be fired
nothing
or whatever.
To me.
It doesn't affect me in the slightest. You know.
It's funny because like when you were describing this, all I could think of, and I mean I don't know why, but all I could think of was like. Truly like some 19th century kids.
That's kind of what it felt like.
Like I was just like, I was, but like literally I pictured them as that. And then I was like, oh, what am I talking? These are like kids in the like these just millennial kids, like 2000 or something.
Yeah, way worse.
Well, you graduated from college, so it would have been like 2010 or something like that. You're younger than me.
Right. So, yeah.
And I graduated from college in 2007, so I don't know what I'm thinking here.
So we know Rittenhouse Square hasn't may have not changed much over the years. But then again, you know, who enjoys being woken up? I'm giving this guy a lot of crap, but like, you know, who enjoys getting woken up by a loud drill at 1 and 3 a.m.?
I don't know. Maybe you should calm down a little bit.
Hey, lay off, right? This guy's long dead.
This guy needs to chill out.
So also in Philadelphia, a celebration of Flag Day occurred on Independence Square with high school choirs and color guards and marching bands. They all gathered for the first time, allowing public and parochial schools to intermingle at this event.
Oh, I'm sure everyone took that well.
Yeah, it was. I mean, they mentioned it in the newspaper, so clearly it was a huge deal. One speaker spoke on how important it was to celebrate Flag Day during these perilous times.
Because they had just heard about the Six Days War.
President Lyndon B. Johnson came to Philadelphia in 1967.
Hey.
So did Martin Luther King. So did the NBA championship trophy, which the Sixers won. So, wow.
Are they allowed to do that?
Big year culturally in Philadelphia. Definitely. You know, middle school, this was a much more tragic event. Middle and high school students staged a walkout as part of a protest of racism, and a riot broke out. It was a huge year for the city, culturally, progressively, and historically. Just ask Ed McMahon as he leads you through the city's many efforts to grow into a metropolis of the future in this video from the Department of Records filmed in 1967 called Philadelphia, a Tomorrow City Today. He talks about investments the city has made in neighborhoods from north to southwest Philadelphia, shows shirtless men using cranes to build tall buildings, discusses the preservation of the Navy Yard, the rapidly expanding airport, which seemed primed to become the air freight center for the entire East Coast, burgeoning education resources, including the 2-year-old community college, the insuring of watermelons for each and every geriatric, the new police cars that are red for some reason and have a light on top, so that squads of 3 policemen can go out on patrol individually, but know to return to their car when the big red light on the top of it starts blinking. That one seemed like
it's like children or something.
It seemed like a swing and a miss. Effectiveness of that.
Okay, you dummies, if you can't figure out how to get back to the car, we're going to set up some systems here.
I mean, splitting up a patrol so that each guy is alone, I think defeats the purpose of sending them out together. And then also, eventually, if not immediately, they're going to not be looking at the police car. So the blinking is useless, right?
Yeah, a little strange. doesn't strike me as a particularly clever way of handling the... I'm not entirely sure what problem they thought they were solving.
Yeah.
Come back from break? Is that what I'm to understand here?
It was like if there was an issue to be solved, the car had a radio in it, but like if there was an emergency or something, it was tough. It was a quick segment of the video and there was no audio except for Ed McMahon narrating. So,
oh wait, yeah. I just unearthed some more Ed McMahon audio. It's this. I'm going to play it right now. Wow. Hey. Amazing. This is incredible stuff.
It was compelling. Yeah. And
I did a lot of research to find that. And you didn't even tell me about this beforehand. We actually took a 5-hour break while I did the research.
I know. You went in deep to unearth a distinct clip.
It's 2 a.m. I actually canceled plans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, also the water. I don't know what you've heard about Philadelphia water, but it's, you know, perfectly clean. The video tells us it's this pure water, and the camera during this voiceover is zooming in on a patch of deep blue choppy river water, talking about how clean and pure it is, and even watching on a laptop screen decades later, I just cringed and cringed the closer we got to it, knowing that this river is now, like, I was gonna say literally, but I think it's you know, the opposite, figuratively running red at this point, because the Philadelphia Rivercast, a system that lets you know, it's a forecast of water quality, according to their website, that predicts potential levels of pathogens in the Schuylkill River between Flat Rock Dam and Fairmount Dam. And the river is listed as red in large,
no.
large letters, which you'll be surprised to learn is not good, and in fact means not suitable for activities involving direct contact with the river.
Yikes.
So not great.
Yeah, that's bad. Why? Also, did you know, why?
Oh, because it's a body of water near people, so it was doomed from the start.
Well, thanks for saying that to me in the nicest possible way. Well, moron.
In much more pleasant news, Fairmount Park turned 100 in 1967.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
Happy birthday, you cool. sweet old gal.
Yeah, that was pretty sweet. But across the state in Pittsburgh, the Phillies were set to get that paltry defense and limp offense into shape. And the Pirates were ready to successfully keep them from doing that. pitching for the Phillies.
Cool.
pitching for the Phillies during the inning of our focus is John Boozer, a 28-year-old right-handed spitballer who was a year away from a rebrand that would turn his career around. But we'll get to John
Not
Boozer.
On the Phillies, I'm assuming.
Well, a little bit on the Phillies, but okay. But yeah, no, we'll get to John Boozer, his story, and how things went for the Phillies on June 9th, 1967, right after this break. Well, John Boozer came out to pitch for the Phillies, Trev. According to the book The Year of the Blue Snow, which we've actually used plenty of times as a reference on this podcast, given its nature, but Year of the Blue Snow is from the Sabre Digital Library, and it's honestly, what's the word I'm looking for here? It's a hallmark member of the Dirty Inning Library.
What is it about?
It is about the 1964 Phillies, and it tells a lot of stories about them that extends beyond the year that is so infamous in Philadelphia. It's edited by Mel Marmer and Bill Nowlin.
I'm glad it goes beyond the year itself, because I feel like the 64 Phillies didn't interest me so much when they were just like, oh, yeah, they're the team that had the flop. But the 64 Phillies fascinate me when it's like, oh, yeah, and here are all the members, and like, and they're terrible, terrible tales. really interesting.
And they actually tell the story about John Boozer that I'm going to tell you now.
Wonderful.
That took place in 1968. So it was even a year after this game that we're talking about today. So in 1968, Boozer would enter a game during a time in which the league was cracking down on one of its most heinous problems: pitchers licking their fingers.
Ugh.
As a notorious
so gross.
Spitballer, Boozer comes into a game to pitch, and as he's warming up, he goes to his mouth. The ump calls ball one, even though it is just a warm-up toss.
That's all that happens? It's you just get called ball one? I thought there was worse repercussions for throwing a spitball.
This is what they apparently were doing at the time.
Huh.
And you know what happens next.
Someone gets real mad.
Ump calls ball one. Oh, someone got mad, all right. Gene Mock comes out of the dugout and screaming at the umpire.
Gene Mock just takes his place at third base and sends the third base coach in. It's like, all right.
The ump tells Gene Mock what the deal is. Mock asks, okay, so what happens if he goes to his mouth again? The ump says, well, I'll call ball two. So Mock goes, okay, orders Boozer, go to your mouth. Boozer does it. Ump calls ball two. They repeat this process for ball three.
Hey, what do you think will happen if we do this again? Gene, please stop.
then the ump just ejects both Gene Mock and John Boozer before Boozer has even thrown a single warm-up pitch.
Incredible.
The next day, the president of the National League has to issue a ruling that no licking your fingers rule doesn't apply to warm-up pitches. So when you wonder why younger people aren't getting into baseball...
Sounds like a reason you would get into baseball. That rocks.
You can get thrown out for licking your fingers.
I love how just completely insane it is to be like, hey, ump, hey, Blue, what happens if I lick my fingers again? It'll just be ball two. Huh, interesting. Lick your fingers, pitcher.
And if I do it a third time, say, what would happen then?
Well, absolutely kick you out. I mean, it's just like, it's not acceptable that you're going to, this is, it'd be really, really bad. Huh. Interesting. Okay. Do it again.
John Boozer, interesting guy, grew up in a town called Kaufmanville, which was populated almost exclusively by a family named Kaufman, which is probably, I'm guessing, it's probably not too uncommon for small American towns in the 30s and 40s to, like, be the product of one family kind of settling down, and then people from outside that area marrying into that family, and the area just expanding.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, okay. But on the other hand, it does also sound one step above a cult. So...
Ooh, yeah, did Boozer get out?
I mean, he's playing baseball for
I don't know. Maybe he has to go back in the fall. Maybe it's like Rumspringa.
Oh, I hear you. But he does go back to his hometown, but doesn't seem to be for anything weird or malicious at the end of the story. But
he's playing baseball with the Phillies. Well, maybe it's like Rumspringa. Oh, okay. Yeah, though, that's totally reasonable.
That's absolutely something you do.
Wow, okay. No, really good point, Trev. I don't know. We have to look into that.
I'm going to go to an amusement park. I'm going to watch TV. Cool. I'm going to go play professional baseball. And they'll just let me do it.
You found the Rumspringa escape clause, basically. Like the one loophole that the Amish can't stop. It's like, ah, geez, as long as he can get a contract, he can be a permanent Rumspringa.
Well, Boozer was expected to be a key player in the Phillies rotation, but it didn't wind up. He didn't wind up having the impact the team wanted to see from him. He was crazy as hell, though, and used to pick up grasshoppers, bite them in half, and then hide the back half under his tongue, and then turn to people and let the desecrated corpse leap out of his mouth. What? He would also eat mouths.
Because it could still move?
Yeah. Uh-huh. It would still jump. What? Like, it was... wasn't so dead it had stopped moving.
What's that
so
about?
So the back half would just thwang out of his mouth at people. Pretty cool, right?
No.
He would also eat moths and other insects. Bob Uecker, John Boozer's friend or teammate on the Phillies, said he would do these things just because he got a kick out of
them. Thanks for changing it before you said friend, because I don't think this person has any friends.
I don't know. I think Bob Uecker's the kind of guy who's friends with everybody. I don't know that for sure. So I don't want to characterize a relationship that wasn't there.
I don't want to characterize Bob Uecker as having friends, especially if the friend is this crazy person.
Oh no, I assume Bob Uecker had everyone was his friend. John Boozer, I don't know if everybody was friends with the guy.
You don't think everyone was friends with Grasshopper Mouth?
Shooting grasshoppers out of his mouth.
Hey, Grasshopper Mouth, come over here.
Hey, what can I do for you?
Oh, God.
What's going to happen if Boozer licks his hand again? Oh, nothing. Just make sure he doesn't throw any of those grasshoppers at me. Hey, Boozer, throw a grasshopper at him.
Boozer, touch your fingers again. Opens his mouth silently, and it just opens like into this gaping maw, and thousands of grasshoppers just come spewing out of his mouth. They consume the umpire. Oh! Driven absolutely out of his mind. Well, in 1967, the Phillies had lost rotation mainstay Chris Short and young hopeful Pedro Ramos to the disabled list. So Boozer got a call up from the minors, where he had been dominating. And his
dominating in his first, by eating a bunch of terrible, terrible food.
In his first four appearances with the Phillies, he logged an 18 ERA. But later he got better. Pitching coach Larry Shepard. Larry Shepard helped him change his grip on his fastball, which seemed to change everything for him. And Shepard also pulled him aside and told him, like, hey, man, you don't have to eat bugs anymore. And maybe you should focus on the pitching instead of all of this.
Did he really say that? Is that true?
I'm not quoting him, but he's credited with having him, like, refocus and say, like, hey, you know, maybe be less of a clown and focus a little more on your pitching. And apparently that helped him, because it worked, and Boozer became a more effective pitcher in the latter seasons of his career.
I just love that someone had to pull him aside and say, like, you know, if you focused as much on pitching as you did eating a bunch of bugs in weird ways, you'd be a great pitcher.
I think you'd be unstoppable. I don't know. Well, after his career, John Boozer went back to his hometown of Kaufmanville to design and build playgrounds, which is very nice.
Is it?
I think so. But today is one of those days, June 9th, 1967, when he earned that ERA of almost 20. So let's talk about that. Rick Wise, like I said, had gotten that start in this one, who I'm sure you remember from Phillies lore as the beloved pitcher who once threw a no-hitter and hit a home run in the same game, and was also the pitcher sent to St. Louis in exchange for Steve Carlton, momentarily infuriating the people of Philadelphia.
You know what really irritates me, though, about this podcast? It's the only thing that irritates me about this podcast, I will admit. It is that literally we have ruined that element of Rick Wise for me. Like, now I do not think of him as the guy who hit two home runs, like it's or like, you know, during a no hitter, like that kind of stuff doesn't matter to me anymore. The only thing that matters to me is he's in so many bad innings, like he's terrible, he has so many problems. I hear Rick Wise and I'm like, oh no, what bad thing is going to happen?
Yes, and I said hit a home run. I had that wrong, obviously. He hit two home runs in that game. And John Stolness and I have talked about that before, that it's probably the greatest single game performance of any baseball player of all time.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I don't know how you beat that. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what else you could possibly do. I guess you could throw a no-hitter. Well, you could throw a perfect game. You could hit two home runs, and you could be a part of every single out. So whether or not it was all strikeouts, or just you ended up getting like all putouts back to the mound or whatever, I guess that's the only way I can imagine it, and that is just so specific and dumb that I'm not going to.
Oh, it would have to be an anomaly of some kind.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, it's never going to happen.
Right.
You're never going to. Well, yeah.
The Pirates, who were not great, entered the game 26-22, having just held that infamous meeting to right themselves and appearing to do so for at least one night at Forbes Field. So when did things start going wrong for Rick Wise? If you guessed immediately, you'd be right. And how did the Pirates attack him? With singles. Singles everywhere. Singles crawling out of the drains, dropping out of the sky, jumping out of the trees.
I'm being killed by all these paper cuts. It's as if I'm...
You wake up...
It's a death by paper cut.
You wake up from that nightmare to see your wife standing there asking you if you had a bad dream. But no, no, she's just a bunch of singles stacked on top of each other. Tonight, the Pirates unloaded a series of one-baggers on the Phillies that made you just wish they'd get an extra base hit and finish them off entirely. Eventually, they did, but it took a while. So shortstop awful. Gene Alley and left fielder.
I hate games like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's not even the inning we're going to talk about. That's just what gave
the Pirates
their...
Oh, I know. I mean, why would that be our inning?
Shortstop Gene Alley and left fielder Manny Mota each had four hits for the Buccos, and Willie Stargell and Roberto Clemente each had three. I wanted to talk about Clemente real quick because we never really have on this podcast, and he's definitely a figure of the, you know, of the eras we discussed.
Yeah, it's odd. We never really do talk about Clemente, do we?
No, and he was one of my favorite old players growing up, and I don't remember what drew me to him because I was never a Pirates fan, and I wasn't a really big, you know, historian as a young child. But I came to know, learn who he was and everything, and I remember doing a book report on Clemente. Like he was definitely somebody I loved back when I was a kid, even though he, you know, had been dead for some time at that point. So some
you were a kid back in the '60s, right?
Some believed Clemente was capable of completing the hallowed 400 batting average for a whole season, but the Pittsburgh Courier wrote that he was a notorious slow starter, having been in the league since 1955 at this point. So this is his 12th year in Major League Baseball. This is a hilarious thing for the Pittsburgh Courier to suggest, given that Clemente was hitting .370 with a .1063 OPS at this point in the season. And remember, it's June 9th. So
yeah, I think he's doing fine.
It was also very par for the course because Clemente wasn't a heavily favored white guy who played for the Yankees, as he explained. Roberto Clemente of the Pirates, this is from the Pittsburgh Courier. Roberto Clemente of the Pirates may have a point when he says he doesn't receive the proper acceptance in baseball. When Mickey Mantle has a pulled muscle, said Clemente, it makes the first page. When I play with a chipped elbow or a bad leg, nobody says anything about it. If I hit 60 homers, they'd tell me the record doesn't count or something else. And he's absolutely right. You know, that's
for sure, of course.
Absolutely how that was. So, in fact, there wasn't a month during this season in 1967 in which Clemente hit under 300.
Jeez.
He also literally hit 400 in May. In 1967, he'd hit .394 versus the Phillies with an .872 OPS, and that was only his third highest slash line against an opposing team.
That's crazy.
He hit, He hit .442 against the Dodgers in 18 games and slugged .769 against the Astros in 16 games. Absolute psychopath. Madman. So the Pirates had used six singles in the first to build their lead. And in our dirty inning, the bottom of the fifth, they used seven more to beat up on poor John Boozer, who just wanted to grab dragonflies out of the air and eat them in peace. So Boozer actually he actually got a couple of outs, two, to lead off the inning, including a strikeout.
Good
job. That this inning went on for so long afterward is astonishing. Matty Alou and Manny Mota each singled, setting themselves apart from the first inning by having their singles actually reach the outfield, though one of them was still a ground ball. Then Clemente, the slow starter, came up and slapped a ground ball single to center field, scoring a run to make it 10-1. Boozer responded by chucking a wild pitch past Willie Stargell. Then his manager opted to just walk the vaunted slugger instead of fooling around with Boozer's clearly pinpoint control.
I love when people are so like looking so bad at that point where the manager's like, okay, look, just this guy's too good, just walk him, please.
Dear God, just put him on base. So that brought up Bill Mazeroski, who you guessed it, ground ball single, punched in two more runs.
Boy, you got to love those meetings, those closed door meetings where all of a sudden you tell people that they can hit singles again.
What's only hit singles? You guys know we could just be going to first base.
Are you kidding me?
We didn't have to be constantly thrown out trying to stretch a single into a double on every play.
Trying constantly to do that. I'm out again. That would have been a great thing if I could just stop at first.
Unfortunately, can't do it.
I got some interesting news for you.
Well, Gene Alley finally got to touch more than one base on a single hit by tripling in the remaining runners. And then Jose Pagan singled him home. So the score is now 15-1. Boozer gave up
again,
one
seems
more.
Bad.
Boozer gave up one more single to Jerry May, who had led off the inning before getting the final out. Yes, John Boozer came out to pitch the next inning. Yes, he pitched the entire rest of the game. Gene Mock wasn't going to ruin anybody else's night out there. In fact, John Boozer's performance in this game is referred to as a sacrifice in the newspaper.
So, I mean, did he do badly in the rest of the game? Like, was it
the game? The game ends 16-1, so that was really the trouble spot.
Okay, that's not great.
The bottom of the first, when the Pirates go up 5-0, is bad. They get a few runs here and there throughout the rest of the game, but nothing like a true meltdown again until the bottom of the fifth, where Boozer has his terrible inning. But no, then he doesn't allow another run until the bottom of the seventh, when he allows a single. The Pirates had a six singles in that first inning.
Goodness.
They had seven in our dirty inning in the fifth. I would love to have a total for you here. I just have to tally.
Please
it
add
up.
It all up. We'll wait.
I'm gonna the amount of singles the Pittsburgh Pirates had in this game on June 9th, 1967. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Eight. 9, 10. 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 20 singles. Yeah. So,
goodness.
That is the exhausting bottom of the fifth inning pitched by poor John Boozer in the 1967 Phillies. Like I said, wouldn't go on to be an incredible team, finished just a hair over .500. They'd lose.
And you know what? It was the fault of that darn Richie Allen.
If only he hadn't blown it. Yeah, but yeah, a lot of figures on this team that you would recognize. And Bob Uecker went on to obviously become the Brewers announcer.
Oh, an amazing announcer! Yeah,
the actor from Major League. Tito Francona was on that team. The father of Terry Francona. Yeah, so there's a lot going on here. So, yeah, brutal
that's
game.
Cool, though. I mean, that's who knew?
Brutal game, poor John Boozer. But that's how the Phillies ended things on June 9th, 1967, and that's how we're going to end things on this episode of
the Dirty Inning. I thought you were going to say the podcast was over.
But thanks for listening. We love doing this podcast. So thanks for listening. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and download all your favorite Phillies podcasts that are a part of the Good Fight Network, including Hidden Season with John Stolness and Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher. Though this week, continued success this week, Liz Rocher has the week off as she prepares for her nuptials.
Oh, come on. You preparing?
We've got a special guest who is so inflammatory he was banned from Twitter. So we've got a fun episode of Continued Success to record this week as well. So, but thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on The Dirty End.
Talk to you next time.